Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. Tonight I'm going to talk about the theme of mindfulness and the three skills. And so kind of what is mindfulness and why would we do it and how do we do it? Those three questions are always pertinent. Mindfulness is such a buzzword these days in our culture and society. You know, it's come from this rich tradition of Buddhism, 2,600-year-old tradition, and has found its way into much as a lot of the Buddhist kind of practices have over the years, it's found its way into our culture. And often throughout history, when Buddhism spread throughout cultures, Buddhism's such a secular and psychology-based form of spiritual or religious practice that the cultures usually influence it more than it influences the culture. And so we, as our kind of Western mind, is we've used mindfulness a lot for increasing productivity and our focus and for a lot of positive benefits, social and emotional learning and mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based relapse prevention for people that are in recovery. They're all mindfulness-based everything, right? And so I want to talk a little bit about what are the basics, what are the kind of foundational principles or skills of the practice, and how do we do it. The first thing I like to say, this is kind of my like very beginner-ish type of spiel that I like to give, and it's good for me to remember and say out loud for myself. Mindfulness itself is not so much a spiritual or religious practice, meaning there's not, you don't really have to have much belief system to do it. And that's kind of a cool thing about it, is you don't really have to subscribe to being a Buddhist, right, or being a Christian, or any type of religious dogma to do it. You can just practice the skill. The second thing I like to say, I call these my five knots, what mindfulness is not. Sometimes you can best describe something first by what it's not. So it's not so much spiritual and religious. It's not about clearing the mind. I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions about meditation, is that this unrealistic expectation that somehow I'm going to just sit up here and close my eyes, and because I assume the posture that my mind's going to be like, all right, I won't bother you for 20 minutes. And then we get really frustrated because it's like, oh my God, I'm totally doing this wrong. I don't think my mind's supposed to be racing and wandering the whole time. If that's your experience, totally doing it right. That's what it's like to have a mind, right? The mind thinks. That's its job. It gets paid to think. You know, just like we wouldn't tell our eyes to stop seeing, or our ears to stop hearing, or our body to stop feeling. The brain, you know, the nervous system, it generates and creates cognition, right? Thoughts. So we're not clearing the mind, but if you look at the word mindfulness, sometimes not the best word, but I think the reason why they called it mindfulness is, why they translated it as mindfulness is, it means to be fully aware of the mind. So sometimes part of the practice is kind of like babysitting your mind. It's like a roommate that you're stuck with. You can't get away from it. It's here for the rest of your life, but you have to live with it. So mindfulness is kind of like, how do we cooperate with having a thinking, restless, wandering mind? So we watch it, we observe it, we monitor it. When it gets too far gone, we bring it back, just like you would a little kid. So that's the second knot. Mindfulness is not about clearing the mind. Mindfulness is also not, you know, this is why this is kind of an introductory spiel. It's not a new age form of meditation. So there are many varieties and forms of meditation. And the new age is something that we coined in the 60s and 70s, where there was this melting pot of spiritual traditions, mostly Eastern traditions, that the hippies kind of threw together in a big pile, and this included varieties of different forms of meditation, transcendental meditation. It included a lot of like Hindu-based chakra systems and the qi, the Chinese qi, qigong, tai chi, those types of systems of meditation. So these aren't all the same thing. That's an important thing to know. Mindfulness is very distinct. It's distinct to what the Buddha taught. There's a set of kind of instructions and a way of practicing. It has its own purpose. It shares some things in common with other forms of meditation, and it differs drastically in some ways too. So it's not a New Age meditation. It's a little bit older than that. And the fourth thing I like to say is that mindfulness is not solely about, I do this mostly in groups with treatment centers where people have no introduction to meditation at all. I tell them it's not about going to sleep. Right? Because one of the things I hear about inevitably is, can I turn off the lights? Can I lay down on the ground? It's why we don't lay down in here. It's why we have chairs and cushions, is because mindfulness is about what we're going to talk about tonight, focus and awareness. And so if we get too kind of lazy during meditation, we lose focus and we kind of check out. And so here's the hard part. It doesn't mean that you're doing it wrong if you fall asleep or you get tired. It's just what is happening in the present. But you want to be aware of that state of mind, and you want to try to bring energy and effort into the meditation practice. So it's not about going to sleep. It's better to be done usually in the beginning of the day, morning or early afternoon or even middle afternoon, rather than right before bed, although it's okay and totally fine to do before bed. The fifth and final thing that I like to say, it's not a experience. And this is one that even as a experienced meditator, I continue to struggle with, which is we're not trying to reach or achieve any type of state during meditation. We're not trying to experience bliss. We're not trying to experience any type of altered consciousness. We're trying to experience exactly what we're experiencing with awareness and with cooperation, with presence. So it's a training, and it's something that this is the kind of good news, is that the more you practice it, the stronger it's going to get. And here's the really good news. All of us already practice mindfulness. It's an innate capacity of having a human brain. In neuroscience, they call it metacognition. Metacognition is the ability to observe thoughts, feelings, and emotions in the present. It's the ability to monitor your own present experience. Human beings can do that. It's something that we've got that's kind of unique to other animals. Like, my dog does not have any self-reflection. My dog's not thinking about what he said to me last week or, you know, what his plans for paying the bills are next week are. He doesn't think about, right? He doesn't think about his mind. He doesn't think about his emotions. He doesn't think about his feelings. And so we have this ability as human beings to train the mind, to train the attention, to notice moment to moment, and to experience what's happening in the present. And so there is an element of progress in meditation practice, but it's tricky to talk about how we progress, because it's not so much that you achieve a state every time you meditate. It just means that your focus, or these three skills we're going to really talk about tonight, focus, sensory clarity, equanimity, which I realize may be weird words right now, but we'll talk about them. But these three skills get stronger the more we practice. And the more you practice, the more you'll notice and you'll gain confidence in the practice. I usually tell people, if you don't meditate at home, totally fine. Try to practice 10 minutes a day for 30 days if you want to start a meditation practice. You'll notice a huge difference, even just 10 minutes of mindfulness in the morning or early afternoon for 30 days in a row. You'll be able to focus more. You'll have more observation of your thoughts and feelings throughout the day. And you'll have more acceptance of or distress tolerance towards difficult things in life. We'll be less reactive, more responsive. And so this is important to talk about, because even though we're not trying to like get a certain state of mind, we're trying to build confidence in meditation. And we want to know that it's worth our while. Right? So, you know, if you find that your mind is really active and hard to kind of collect in the beginning, you get to notice that that will collect more over time. It's like I wouldn't go up to an NFL player and say, hey man, I can't throw the ball 40 yards. I hate sports, by the way. I don't know why I make these references. But he would say, all right, how much do you practice? And I'd say, like a lot of people say to me with meditation, well, I've tried it a few times. And he'd be like, yeah, no shit, you can't throw the ball 40 yards. So this is, I say this to be empowering rather than belittling, meaning that you can build the power of mindfulness. So those are the five knots. It's not necessarily spiritual, religious. It's not about clearing the mind. It's not new age. It's not about going to sleep. And it's not an experience. It's a training. So what is it? It's a hard thing to define. If a Buddhist scholar was in the room right now, I would be really scared to even approach defining mindfulness because there are so many characteristics to it. But I've kind of created a definition that I think works good enough. I've changed the definition like 5 times over the course of the last 2 years, so we'll see where it ends up in a year or so. But for right now, mindfulness is an ability to focus awareness into the present experience, into the here and now, and to calmly acknowledge thoughts, emotions, physical sensations as they come and go. So it's an ability to focus into the present experience. The present experience is not a noun. There's no such thing as a present moment. We say it because it's easy to say. But a moment is like a place you can get to. You know, a moment has this kind of definitive nature to it. But a moment is fleeting. A moment is alive with sound. You can hear sounds. Your body will feel. Your mind will wander. You ever think about how the mind is in the present moment? If you watch your mind, you can observe it move around to thoughts and plans and memories. So you can observe your mind in the present moment. It's kind of a trippy thing to think about. So we'll talk about this in a little bit. It's an ability to focus into the here and now and to calmly, this is important, calmly acknowledge thoughts, feelings, and emotions, meaning we don't make a problem out of anything that's happening. There's no right or wrong situation or circumstance that we find. What we're experiencing is what is. You know, we're trying to learn how to be with what is. It doesn't mean we passively, like, accept all of the conditions of our life. It just means that during mindfulness, we're working a lot on the acceptance skill. Meaning, in the beginning, you get a little bit of an itch. Try to sit with it for a little bit. And if you observe the feeling or the sensation, stop calling it itch and just feel it and see what happens to this feeling. It will ebb and flow. So it may get really sharp and then it may kind of die down. And then it will come back really sharp and then it will die down. And this feeling will come and go. And eventually the itch will pass altogether because all things come and go. And so mindfulness is about how can we be with our experience with an even mind and let it come and go. Calmly acknowledge it. That's the definition. So the three skills. If I was to say this in a simple way, I'm kind of a simple person. I like to think I'm smart, but it gets me into more trouble than it benefits me a lot of the time. So what the three skills are in meditation are presence, awareness, and acceptance. Presence, being here. Awareness, being aware of what's happening here. Acceptance, being okay with what's happening here. Those three things. But if you kind of break it down, they get a little bit more subtle and more a little bit more depth to them. So the first is focus. Focus is a power that we develop. It's an ability to place your attention where you considered it to be relevant at a given time. So you may notice that we don't always have the ability to place our attention where we need it to be at a given time. I like to always say the mind has a mind of its own. So the mind, the attention, it's not always, we don't always have agency over it. It kind of jumps. You see a car, you think of your ex because the ex drove the same car, and then you're thinking of the past, and then you're like, oh my God, I'm so lonely, and then you think about, you know, dating and how dating sucks, and then you see someone on the street that looks really attractive, and then you wonder what your life is like with them, and then you hear the bank teller wake you up from your daydream and say, hey, you know, next in line, come on, right? Your attention's just floating around. And the mind's very powerful, so obviously a lot of what our attention goes to is kind of this inner world of thought. And our thoughts have potency. They're really urgent at times, and they're really convincing. And the stories, the subject of our thoughts are us and who we are and how we're doing and where we're going. And we rarely kind of question that. We just kind of believe the story that the mind tells us, and that's where we get into a lot of trouble. So focus is the ability to notice where your attention is and to be able to have the choice to place it where you need it to be. One of the benefits of focus during meditation is that we can start to ignore our mind. We can start to have the ability when the mind wanders during meditation to gently and calmly tell the mind, not right now, come back. And we usually focus on something like the breath or the sounds that are in the present or the feeling of your hands or your feet on the floor, something that's kind of stable and present. I like to just say anything but the mind. That's a good foundation of mindfulness. It's a good anchor. And as you anchor your attention, you focus on the breath or you focus on the sounds, you focus on the contact, the feeling of your body, what will happen is your mind, the emotion of the mind, will start to become less neurotic, less stressful, and you'll start to calm down. And you can notice this during meditation as you meditate 10, 20 minutes. Usually by the end, not all the time, but most of the time, you'll feel a little bit more calm, a little bit more peace of mind than you did in the beginning. That's because the attention's been collecting. So this collecting the mind focus helps to develop calm and tranquility. In neuroscience, for those who care, they say that attention can only be present in one mind moment. So that means that your attention's only one thing at a time. When we multitask, we don't hold two things in mind. You alternate your attention between two things, or you have a wide awareness and you kind of more pay attention, 70% this thing's kind of in the background, and then you go to this thing and this thing's kind of in the background. So your attention can really only be in one place at a time. And when you train your attention, when you focus on your breath, it really helps you to seclude yourself from the neurotic obsessiveness, rumination, all the thoughts that generate a lot of stress for us. So this creates calm and tranquility. This also helps us to get a healthy distance from our thoughts, right? If we kind of have this metaphor of having the roommate, this is like kind of confronting the roommate and being like, hey, like you can't listen to music right now, I'm trying to study. Or hey, you can't talk to me right now, I'm trying to be with my breath. You know, telling your mind, hey, I understand you want to really think about your plans next week, but I'm going to just pay attention to this boring ass breath for a couple minutes. And the mind doesn't like that because the mind's not entertained by the breath. The mind wants to plan, it wants to remember, it wants to do its job. But we can break the addiction to the thinking mind. And in particular, two things happen with thinking. One is the mind's very urgent. So the mind has this kind of tendency to convince us the thing that it wants to think about needs to be thought about right now. And you'll notice this during meditation. You'll have a really great idea, or you'll remember something you had to do, or you'll be sitting at home and you have your timer set for 20 minutes. Your mind will convince you to get off the cushion easily. The mind's very convincing because it's urgent. It's like, well, if you don't do this now, you're going to forget. So we learn to let that go, the urgency of the mind, and we learn how to really relax the tendency to have obsessiveness and impulsivity in our daily lives, right? You know those moments where the mind's kind of like, react, just say the thing, you know, fight the person, do the thing now. And we have that ability to be like, wait a second, I don't have to do it right this second. That's why I love email so much. It's like, gives me an opportunity to really break urgency. I get an email, I can't tell you how many times I've written like a novel, and it's like so good, and I know I'm going to totally own them. I have all the points down. And then I reread it, and I'm like, this is not a good idea for me to send this and just delete the whole email. So having that ability to let go of the urgency, and also to be able to kind of, the mind is, I call this lawyer mind. The mind has this tendency to build evidence. So it just creates stories. Really big stories, really important. The mind feels very important. So it feels urgent, it feels important. And we can, you know, learn how to, even when the mind creates a story during meditation, we can see it and be like, okay, that's the story the mind's telling right now. I don't have to go into it. I don't have to go create more story with it. And so a way to practice with focus is, like I said, mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of sound, mindfulness of the body. They call this the first foundation of mindfulness, being able to really connect with something that's stable, that's not thinking. And then what happens is you develop kind of an objective vantage point. So it's kind of like in the beginning of the first meditation where I said, collect all of the stress in your life and imagine that you're walking it outside and putting it down for a little bit. Of course, it's going to knock on the door and be like, hey man, I got tons of shit to tell you right now. But you can see it a little bit better when you have the intention to put it aside. So when you're focusing on the breath, over and over and over, when your mind jumps, you can notice it quicker. Because you have a new reference point, the breath. That's where you're focusing. So when your mind says, hey man, think about this, you're able to be like, nope, not right now. You can see the thought clearer. And this sets us up for the second part, sensory clarity. I call this awareness or observer mind. So this is the ability to, during meditation, I would teach this in a secular setting this way, to be the one who observes the experience instead of the one that is the experience. So just seeing a thought as a thought. A sound is a sound. Of course the mind will label the sound. A fire truck goes by, you'll hear the siren. You may say siren, or you may think of or imagine a fire truck, or you may think of your uncle who's a fireman, or whatever. So of course your mind's going to create labels, but you can just notice that as a thought. It's a visual thought, it's an auditory, that voice in your head, you know how we all have this kind of inner narrator? It's just thinking. It's not who we are. If that was who we are, we could tell it again to stop, and it would listen to us, but it doesn't. It just chit-chats. That's what the mind does. So we can just notice sensory clarity is an ability to track and monitor moment-to-moment sensory experience. What is sensory experience? Kind of a big word. It's six things. Thinking, hearing, feeling, smelling, tasting. What am I missing? Seeing. So it's these six things. These are really the six sense bases in Buddhism. It's the only thing that the present is composed of. Sights and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts and sounds. Now they combine. You have thoughts and feeling. That's emotion. Emotion's very powerful. But you can see its component parts. When you have an emotion, you'll have a story, thinking. You'll have a mental attitude, which is maybe agitation, restlessness. And you'll have the contracting feeling, hot feeling. That's what the experience is in the present. That's sensory clarity. So the benefit of having sensory clarity is that you can just see that the thing is what it is. It's a thought and it's a feeling, and it loses its power a little bit. It doesn't mean that, like, in reality it's not valid or it's not happening. It just means that we can see it for face value. It's an emotion. It's in my mind. They call this introspective awareness. So you can start to take more responsibility for the emotions that are in you. You can take more power away from their potential to overwhelm you and to spill out into your relationships and to spill out into your reactions. You can be like, oh, I am really pissed off right now. I notice the thought, the self-righteousness in my mind. I notice the feeling, the urgency. Wow, that's really big. Can I get out of the story for a second, 10 minutes? It's like, then you learn that focus skill. You learn how to tell your mind not right now. So you can say, all right, how about your anger, resentment story is just there for a second, and I just relax my body, be with the feeling. And then the story says, hey man, but they really wrong. And you're like, all right, just for a second, take a breath, relax. And then what happens is your emotion, your limbic system starts to kind of settle. And you get your executive function back. Your brain, if you think of an executive at a company or organization, they make the decisions. I don't think it's the best analogy because I don't think executives always make the best decisions. But this is like, in the best case scenario, executive. Right? It's all you got. That's who you hired. So get the limbic system calmed down. Get out of the story. Be aware that it's just a thought, it's just a feeling. See what it is for what it is. Be with the experience and it will start to calm down, and then you can act instead of react. So I call this observer mind. Observer mind helps you to see cause and effect. So in the example I gave earlier, you see a car, you think of your ex, and you're able to observe that causal relationship. So you can actually start to track. This was really helpful when I started to practice mindfulness amidst a pretty severe depression, which is what brought me in here. I was able to see how my thoughts were feeding or fueling the feelings of worthlessness or hopelessness or despair. Not that the depression I could really control. I mean, the feeling would just come. It's like kind of this heavy blanket, just that like, kind of feeling. But when I would feel like that, my mind would go to all the worst things in my life and be like, hey, pull this one up. And I'd be able to watch how that thought would lead to this thought, which would lead to this feeling, which would lead to this. And I could see, and I would be really suffering. I'd like be in my car and I'd be like, how did I get here? And then I was like, oh, I was thinking about my ex, right? I saw this car and then I thought about my ex and I brought up all that resentment, and that's why I feel the way I do. And because I was able to track and monitor my thoughts, it gave it a little bit less power. And so I'm not going to go into this part, but it is very important to say, because it's what I'm talking about is mostly secular mindfulness, meaning mindfulness for the sake of stress reduction, for the sake of having more clarity, more acceptance. But there's kind of this other part of practicing mindfulness for the purpose of liberation. What does that mean? It's a whole nother conversation. Liberation from a Buddhist perspective is nothing special, so it sounds like a very powerful word, but it means to be able to see things as they are in reality, to see the nature of experience itself. What is the nature of the mind? Well, the Buddha says the nature of the mind is that it's not self. It's not who you are. It's just the mind. The mind is a conditioned set of patterns of perception. It's a conditioned set of patterns of inclination, right? That there's no singular thing that we can point to in our experience that we can call ourselves. The self is not a thing. It's a thing in process. It's thoughts and sounds and smells and feelings and all of these memories and perceptions that are based on past experiences that get acted and reacted. So there's some depth to this I can't really do service to, but there's a way of practicing mindfulness to develop deep insight into the nature of experience. In Zen Buddhism, they just call this emptiness. Or into the nature of how craving and clinging in the mind cause suffering. Or into the nature, this is one everyone can get behind, of impermanence. That the mind state you had this morning is not the mind state you have right now. It may come back, but then it will go away. But then it will come back, but then it will go away. So all things change. So the observer mind, one of the ways to practice is something that's called noting or labeling practice. You don't have to practice this way. Some people teach this system. I spent a month in Myanmar recently practicing this system of meditation called noting practice. And noting practice is the practice of using a simple note or label to calmly name, almost like a whisper in your mind, what you're experiencing in the present. Noting helps to direct your experience into a simple rudimentary form instead of letting it wander off into distraction. So noting could just be as simple as when your mind's wandering, silently, calmly in the mind saying the word wandering. Or when the mind's wandering, calmly, internally saying the word thinking. It can get more descript. But the importance with noting is to not analyze. The note's not trying to change the thought. The note's not trying to make you a better meditator. It's just trying to simply notice, to note where your attention is in each moment. And so you note thinking. You could note planning, remembering, daydreaming. There are kind of a few notes that I recognize a lot in my mind. Planning, which is anything that's going to happen after right now. Remembering, which is anything that happened before right now. daydreaming or wandering, sometimes I'll say it, where just random, weird, no reason thoughts or images or whatever come into the mind. I just call that all daydreaming, wandering. Or narrating or evaluating. Narrating is that voice in the mind that's saying, just talking to you. And evaluating is a really good note for experienced meditators because they start getting too analytical and thinking about what they're doing. And when you're thinking about what you're doing, just call that evaluating. Notice the thought, note the thought, let the thought pass, come back to the breath. So noting can be also used to help you focus. Some people, early on, they'll count their breath. Some people hate doing this, so if you don't want to do this, don't do it. If it just makes you restless and makes it hard to kind of focus, you don't need to. But some people like to say the word one as they breathe in or as they breathe out. And then on the next in-breath or out-breath, they'll say the word two. Right? And they go up to 10 and then back down to one. And each time the mind wanders, they note it, and then they start back over at one. So it kind of gives the mind something. It gives it a task that's present-centered. So it's kind of like a trick for an active mind. If you have a very active mind, you're like, okay, mind, you won't leave me alone while I focus on the breath, so I'll give you something to do. Note the breath. When it breathes in, when you breathe in, say the word in. When you breathe out, say the word out. When your mind wanders, note where it goes. And then when you note that, come back to the breath and note that. It's like having a little kid at work that can't really do anything, but you give him something simple to do. Or give her something simple to do, right? You just give them something that is rudimentary. So noting can keep the meditator present. It gives the mind something to do. It helps you to develop sensory clarity, which is better acknowledgement and recognition of what's occurring as it's occurring. It helps you to, this is really crucial, identify and track the habits of your mind. So you get to really know what your mind likes to do. And it becomes more impersonal. I was on retreat, like I said, in Myanmar. I've sat a couple really long retreats. And one of the things that happens is when you have a whole month to meditate where you're not talking to anyone, you're not writing, you're not doing anything fun, the mind just comes up with the same like 6 or 7 stories. Right? It's like you have only 6 or 7 songs, like an EP playing in your head of just like the same thing. And the mind's like has nothing to do, so it just keeps coming up with these same. So you can start to track the and notice those flavors. And what I started to do is I would just kind of label that as a thing. I'd be like, because I teach Buddhism, one of the things that happens is I'd have an insight and I'd think about how I was going to teach it. Right? And then I just call that teaching, teaching, teaching. Let the teaching go, come back. And so you can start to track and identify the patterns of your own mind. That's a very powerful tool. It also helps to support a non-reactive form of attention, like I talked about earlier, just seeing a thing for what it is instead of making it feel unique or extra special. All right, the problems with noting, it can become rote or mechanical. So it can just kind of feel like a lot of times, like, what am I doing anymore? I'm just sitting here noting what I'm noting, right? It can get confusing. If it gets confusing, just stop doing it and focus on the breath because it's not the end game. It's just something. It's just something that should always feel useful. If it doesn't feel useful, drop it. It can become object oriented. Like I said before, you can think you're trying to get something done and get a little bit too kind of wrapped up in it. It can be an attempt to try to control or drive one's experience. It's like the more I note, maybe my mind will stop, and we get that kind of misconception. Or the labels can become harsh. This is one of the things you can work with if you do like noting. Look at the tone of your voice. The tone of your voice can kind of help you also notice your mental attitude, which is a very subtle thing. So, you know, if you're noting and you're like, wandering, 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 you can just note the mental attitude, which is agitated, agitated. Okay, it's agitated. So you just want to look at the tone. All right, so that's enough on the observer mind, sensory clarity, observer mind. And the third and perhaps the most important of the three skills, these all work together, by the way. You can't actually separate one from another. The only one you can really work on very isolated is concentration. But sensory clarity, equanimity, they kind of all blend together. Equanimity is just a weird word for an ability to be with your present experience without having to fix, change, or control it. So one of the closest words to equanimity is like radical acceptance. Acceptance is, it just means having the ability to be with what's happening without having to influence it, without having to get pulled away by it or push on it. So the definition I wrote up here, it's the ability to allow sensory events, thoughts, feelings, emotions, sights, smells, sounds, tastes, to come and go without push or pull. An inner balance between the extremes of pushing the senses down, which we call suppression. So mindfulness isn't just another way to ignore or suppress feelings or thoughts. You're actually letting them fully happen. But you're being with the experience without pushing it down and without also being pulled away into it. Easier said than done. But that's kind of one of the practices that we develop over time. And the psychological equivalent of this, something they talk about in psychology, is distress tolerance. Having an ability to sit with our experience, especially difficult experiences. There's a guy named Daniel Siegel that studies the window of tolerance, and he says that the more that we sit with what we're experiencing, the window of tolerance expands, and we can be with more. So I always tell, I work a lot with addicts, and I say, you know, addiction's this strategy of getting pleasure and avoiding pain. But I tell them the existential problem with addiction is that life is both pleasurable and painful. There's no escape from that reality. It's always going to have pain to it. So the best strategy is not addiction, which is get pleasure, avoid pain. It's to become more comfortable with being uncomfortable. It's being able to actually experience and sit with some discomfort and to have compassion for it. And to, even during the meditation, I'll sometimes talk to myself. If something's really difficult, I'll be like, dude, it's totally okay. I'm with you. You can relax. I care about you. It's okay. And as my attitude softens, I can be with the experience better. Right? And so we don't want to be rigid about developing distress tolerance. There are different schools of thought on this. Some Buddhist meditative disciplines, especially Zen practice, has something called strong determination practice. And this is something that they really recommend in Burma as well, as they tell you not to move. So in Zen, you may do even like 2 or 3 or 4 hour meditation sits on retreats and not move. Because what happens is your ability to be with the pain increases so much during the sit that the pain dissolves altogether, which is something that could be fun to think about. But it's not really a worthy endeavor unless you're really interested in sitting Zen retreats. So I like to kind of have the middle path, which the Buddha prescribed, which is, if it's really unbearable, just move. If you have a really unbearable feeling or experience, definitely move and get rid of it. But try to sit with it first for a little bit and see if you can be with it and see if you can name it. And then if you decide that you can't, shift and move and itch. So equanimity is the non-interfering quality of mindfulness. It's the ability to be with your experience without push or pull. One of my favorite quotes, we'll do some meditation practice here in a moment. One of my favorite quotes about equanimity, I quote it a lot, is a Thai forest master, meditation master, a guy named Ajahn Chah, says that, he has this quote where he says that if you practice mindfulness diligently, your mind will become clear, like a still forest pool. He said, and all sorts of strange and wonderful creatures will come and drink from the pool. And so this is like what the equanimity is referring to, which is this ability to be with. The word for equanimity in Pali Sanskrit, upekka, means there in the middleness. It's the ability to be with the experience, letting the thoughts come and go. He says it's like a still forest pool where all sorts of strange and wonderful creatures come and drink from the pool. So the thoughts still come. Right? This makes me feel good if you believe in like awakening and enlightenment, which you don't have to, but it means that the enlightened mind isn't a mind that's free of thoughts. It's not a mind that's free of feeling. It's a mind that has feeling and has thoughts, but it's a mind that can be even and be aware and be present and let the thoughts come and go. And so that's something that I feel like isn't too far-fetched. It's something that I can notice during meditation, is moments of calm and clarity, equanimity, even-mindedness. So these are some of my thoughts on an overview of how to practice. We're going to do